Hi there, folks. Got some good news and bad news. Good news is that, yes, I've got the pop filter all handled. This episode is going to sound great in terms of pops and hisses. Bad news is the microphone was placed in an odd spot, and so things bumped it pretty regularly, so you're gonna hear a lot of thumps. I really swear I'm dialing this in. I'm a few episodes ahead, and these problems are solved for the long term. It's just, yeah, still working on it at this point. Thank you all very much for your patience, and enjoy the show. Hello, and welcome to Half Price Horror, where we get our terror at a discount and pass the savings on to you. Half Price Horror is a spoiler-heavy podcast that takes a deep dive into scary movies curated by the selection at the local Half Price bookstore. I'm your host, John, and today we'll be taking a look at Silent Hill from 2006. Written by Roger Avery from a treatment by Christoph Gans and Nicholas Boukrieff, and directed by Christoph Gans. The treatment was loosely based on the 1999 Konami video game Silent Hill, which was originally released for the PlayStation and which producer Samuel Hadida brought to Gans' attention during the filming of his 2001 cult classic Brotherhood of the Wolf. Which I've debated about doing because on the one hand it's really more of a kung fu conspiracy thriller historical drama with a monster at the very end than an out-and-out horror movie, but on the other hand, it's freaking amazing. Like Resident Evil, Silent Hill began its life as an attempt to recreate Hollywood-style horror within the very different environment of a video game. But instead of a zombie movie, the inspiration Keiichiro Toyama drew from was the legacy of psychological horror. Restricted by technical limitations to a very short draw distance, that's the amount of the environment the computer can actually animate at a time, they came up with the idea of a city shrouded by fog and shadows, and developed a story about a man searching for his missing daughter in a city that was slowly transforming into a living nightmare. Gans decided to make the main character a mother instead of a father, because he felt it was more naturalistic to have a woman concerned about her child, and as a father myself, fuck you, and as a feminist, fuck you, and the horse you rode in on. Nonetheless, when he managed to secure the rights after 5 years of lobbying Konami, then brought the treatment to Roger Avery, who is at the time still very much best known for his Academy Award-winning screenplay for Pulp Fiction, co-written with Quentin Tarantino, the writer did his best to honor the essence of the original game, which he very much loved, and to flesh out the relationship between Rose De Silva and her daughter Sharon into something deep and meaningful. Having listened to some episodes of Video Archives and heard the interaction between Avery and his real-life daughter Gala, I would still very much like to read a version of this that focused on a loving father, because I feel like Avery could write the hell out of it. But I think he took the brief he was given and did an amazing job. Avery also drew inspiration from the real-life story of Centralia, Pennsylvania, which was rendered uninhabitable after a 1962 fire spread underground and connected with the local coal deposits, turning the entire area beneath the town into a slow-burning but impossible-to-douse blaze that belched toxic gases and created unpredictable sinkholes. The governor invoked eminent domain to buy out and evacuate all but a few remaining residents in 1992, and as of 2021, only 4 people remain. The fog and falling snow of the video game became fumes and falling ash, an element that resonated so strongly with fans of the series that to this day a lot of people think Centralia was the origin of the original game as well. When the script was finally approved by the studio and Konami, their only major note that the film was going to be marketed to teenage boys and 20-something men, and there were no significant male characters in it, was solved by beefing up the role of Christopher De Silva and adding a new character, police officer Thomas Gucci. Casting began for the film. The most important role, that of Rose herself, went to Radha Mitchell, an Australian actor who was more or less at the high water mark of her career at the time, thanks to high-profile back-to-back parts in Finding Neverland, Melinda and Melinda, and Man on Fire, all of which came out in the same year. Horror fans might be more familiar with her from Pitch Black or the thriller Phone Booth. She's never stopped working, though, getting regular parts in genre flicks and prestige dramas alike. You might have seen her in the 2010 remake of The Crazies, or the action movie Olympus Has Fallen and its sequels, or very recently opposite Bob Odenkirk in Life Upside Down. She also returned for the sequel to this movie, Silent Hill Revelation, which I'll admit surprised me because the film had a reputation as a cheap cash-in, and I'd assumed they didn't shell out to get back the original cast. They not only got Mitchell back, but they got back Sean Bean from the original Silent Hill as well. Bean was also riding very high in 2006 when he starred in this movie. He'd gotten his big break in 1993 in the Sharp TV series, where he played a British soldier in the Napoleonic Wars, taking the part away from future Dr. Paul McGann after he injured his knee playing football and was unable to participate in filming. There's your token Doctor Who connection for the episode. He then parlayed that into a role as 006, the villain of the extremely well-received James Bond film GoldenEye, and from there became a superstar thanks to his appearance in the Lord of the Rings movies for Peter Jackson. His star's only risen since then, thanks to the Game of Thrones series, which also established his reputation as a man who gets killed off in virtually everything he appears in. So many people were astonished when I told him that not only does he survive this entire movie, he's pretty much the only one who does. Spoilers. Rose and Christopher's adopted daughter, Sharon, is played by Jodell Ferland, who also essays the role of Alessa as a child, and Dark Alessa, the possible manifestation of Satan, who expresses the adult Alessa's rage. This is a very gothic movie, and the convoluted and messy and occasionally contradictory plot is all part of the aesthetic. Ferland gravitated to the role of creepy kids from a pretty early age, appearing in the movie They and the 2002 TV movie version of Carrie. It's the one where Carrie survived at the end and went on the run in a backdoor pilot for a TV series that would have been pretty freaking weird if it ever came to pass. Carrie led her to another Stephen King project, the TV series Kingdom Hospital, which is 100% the inspiration for Garth Marenghi's Dark Place, and you cannot convince me otherwise. This brought her to the attention of Silent Hill's casting director, Deirdre Bowen, and she's been able to snag horror roles without too much trouble ever since. She was Patience Buckner in The Cabin in the Woods, Aggie in Paranorman, Bree in the Twilight Saga Eclipse, and more recently she's been a regular on the TV series Dark Matter and a guest star on Supernatural. Officer Sybil Bennett, whose ill-considered and possibly illegal pursuit of Rose and Sharon sparks the inciting incident of the movie, is played by Laurie Holden. Holden is one of our favorite things on this podcast, a Canadian character actor and day player who spent much of the 90s popping up as a guest star in all those US-Canadian co-productions we love so much. She was in The Father Dowling Mysteries, Captain Power and the Soldiers of the Future, Highlander, Due South, Tech War, Tech Lab, The Outer Limits, and Poltergeist the Legacy, before graduating to a recurring role on The X-Files as Marita Covarrubias, and appearances in some big films like The Majestic and Fantastic Four. She has the tough part of being Ben Grimm's ex-fiance, the one who rejects him for his appearance. After Silent Hill, she went on to appear in The Mist and The Walking Dead because Frank Darabont never lets go of an actor he likes, and she's currently the Crimson Countess in The Boys. Deborah Kara Unger, who plays Dahlia, Alessa's birth mother and therefore the weird spiritual demi-parent of Sharon, look, we'll get into it, I promise, there's kind of a lot of shit going on in this movie, is probably best known for her voice role as Scorpio in a number of Star Wars The Old Republic video games. But she's been a consistently working actor in genre roles, including the recent 2022 horror film The Long Night, 1999's Payback, 1997's The Game, and 1994's Highlander The Final Dimension, but let's not hold that against her. But we kid the Highlander sequels. Dahlia's sister, Christabella, the ultimate villain of the piece, which is pretty impressive for a movie that has bent-backed sexual predators, twisted-faced children, sexy murder nurses, and a 7-foot-tall man in an Iron Plague Doctor helmet wielding a sword bigger than he is played by Alice Krieg, one of our true genre legends. After taking an acting class on a lark in college, the South African actor rapidly got a breakout role in Chariots of Fire and followed it up with a star-making turn in an adaptation of Peter Straub's Ghost Story, a movie that sadly pales in comparison to the book. She mostly followed her prestige drama muse after that, but every time she's dipped her toe back into the genre well, the results have been unforgettable. 1992's Sleepwalkers, 1996's Star Trek First Contact, where she was the Borg Queen, Reign of Fire, the Children of Dune miniseries for sci-fi, all the way up to the recent film She Will. She just always lends a touch of class to everything she's involved in, and Silent Hill is no exception, even though by all accounts she didn't think much of the role. She thought the character was too one-dimensionally evil, which honestly she kind of is, but this is a gothic. Subtle kind of goes out the window here. A brief but significant role is played by Tanya Allen, who appears as religious fanatic and helpful source of exposition Anna. Allen is another Canadian actor who spent the 90s racking up roles in syndicated genre fare, including The Outer Limits, Tech War, and Kung Fu, The Legend Continues. She then picked up a long-term role as Percy Montana in the TV series Star Hunter, which is not, I repeat, not based on Space Hunter Adventures in the Forbidden Zone, despite both of them involving a group of bounty hunters in the 23rd century, and she reprised her role in it for the reworked and remastered version Star Hunter Redo. She was also in the 2020 movie The Nest, not to be confused with the 2021 movie The Nest. Playing a larger, but not necessarily significant role, is Kim Coates as Officer Thomas Gucci. Coates is a character actor who's been popping up in action movies and crime thrillers ever since his early guest appearance on Miami Vice in the late 80s. Along the way, he's taken in the War of the Worlds TV series, The Amityville Curse, Dracula the series, The Last Boy Scout and Bad Boys, Innocent Blood, the RoboCop TV series, Kung Fu the Legend Continues, and Poltergeist the Legacy. So, yes, he's another Canadian syndicated day player. We love each and every one of them. As well as Battlefield Earth, Black Hawk Down, Pearl Harbor, and the remake of Assault on Precinct 13. He's probably most famous, though, for his 92-episode stint as Tig Traeger on Sons of Anarchy. And last, but in many ways most important, dancer and choreographer Roberto Campanella served as the movement coordinator on the set, helping to train the actors to give the exact kind of creepy, unnerving performances that best suit their characters. Famously, he left early one day and Gans wound up having to scrap an entire sequence because choreographing it himself turned out so disastrously. He plays the creepy janitor whose sexual assault is a sort of proximate cause of the whole story, as well as the undead bent-backed version of that same janitor and the giant pyramid head monster who makes several appearances throughout the story. This greatly bothered purists because the pyramid heads don't show up in the series until the second game, but come on. That's the kind of amazing visual you're not going to say no to. And speaking of amazing visuals, the movie opens with one of the most gorgeous houses I've ever seen in a motion picture. Spacious and modern and with a lovely view of a big patch of unspoiled forest. It immediately tells you that the De Silva family has capital M money. Because this isn't even the kind of very nice house that Hollywood gives to working class families because they don't know how much anything costs anymore. This is a rich people house. And the fact that Rose and Christopher are emerging from it in the middle of the night, screaming for their missing daughter Sharon, reminds us that there are some problems that money can't solve. Sharon's gone sleepwalking again, and when Christopher spots her out in the woods, Rose goes sprinting after her. She goes underneath the highway and along a creek that empties out into a river basin, a steep and terrifying drop that's gorgeously photographed by cinematographer Dan Laustsen. This kind of high aerial shot is popular and easy these days thanks to drones, but back in 2006, a lot of cranes and helicopters had to be deployed to get this kind of beautiful footage. This was all shot at the Devil's Punch Bowl in Hamilton, Ontario, and the layers of striation to the rock carved away by 450 million years of flowing water is truly majestic to behold. This opening really does throw a lot of eye candy at you. Sharon is at the edge, of course, as we all knew she would be, sleepwalking and seeing the falls in her dreams as a deep shaft, crisscrossed by metal walkways and heading down into a lake of fire. Yes, my usage of that term is intentional. We're gonna get some explicit shoutouts to the Book of Revelations later on. Down at the bottom, we see an identical girl looking up at her, this one with a cruel smile on her ash-streaked face. But just then, Rose comes racing up and tackles her daughter away from the cliff, and Sharon wakes up screaming, "Home! Home! Silent Hill! Silent Hill!" Christopher arrives a moment later, his too little too late approach reminiscent of his entire role in this film, and the three of them huddle together in a shot that perfectly frames a massive lighted cross some distance away, as if to say, yes, these are people of great faith as well as great wealth, and what's that doing for them? Nothing. We then get the title card, and we emerge from it into bright sunlight as Sharon sits under a tree in a luxurious meadow, drawing pictures of animals living together in perfect harmony. And if this all lays it on a bit thick, it's because this is a film that's going to be spending a lot of time in dirty, grimy, ash-dusted, crumbling ruins of post-industrial America, and we need to hit that contrast hard if we want to understand that Sharon is the shining and pure opposite of all that. Particularly as she's not going to be in very much of the film once we get to Silent Hill proper. Rose comes up to her, and the two of them cuddle and talk about the drawings and meow at each other like cats, and again, it's very brief but intensely intimate, because we only have pretty much this scene to establish the bond between these two as something that would drive Rose to almost literally descend into the bowels of hell to save her daughter. And it worked, at least for me. The meowing thing felt very real, the kind of adorable little play that parents and children indulge in because children haven't learned yet how not to be strange, and parents relish the chance to rediscover their own strangeness. And I immediately bought that yes, this is a real mother and a real daughter, and they've got a special and loving bond. Although it is still significant that Sharon was adopted. Not because that makes the parent-child bond any less real, of course, but because all of the major figures in this movie deal with the mother-daughter relationship in very different ways, and all of them are mothers without a father, at least symbolically. Rose has a husband, of course, but he's shut out of the narrative and he didn't impregnate her, so in a sense Sharon is the product of a virgin birth. Sybil is strongly queer-coded, but she's given a maternal instinct so powerful it drives her to make the fatal mistake that incites the whole sequence of events we're about to see, and she's constantly looking for a surrogate child. Dahlia refuses to name the father of her child, and it's heavily implied that Alessa might have been an actual virgin birth that the leaders of her church simply couldn't recognize right in front of their very eyes. And Christabella sees herself as the mother to her congregation, even though her actual nurturing instincts are entirely lacking and she only knows how to operate as a tyrannical authority figure. These different aspects of the concept of motherhood, as reflected in culture and history, are going to be very important to the film as we progress. The pair get up and go back to their car, and it's made clear to us that this was only a rest stop on a long drive to Silent Hill, the town Sharon's been dreaming about. Rose gets a call on her cell phone as they leave that she refuses to answer, and that, along with Sharon's question, "Daddy's not coming?" again tells you a lot in a very brief period of time about the strain in their relationship, Christopher's opinions on Rose's decision to take her daughter to Silent Hill, and the impact of her choice to ignore her husband and make the drive anyway. It makes the brief scene immediately afterward, where Christopher is seen from his end saying, "Damn it, Rose, what's going on?" and looking up Silent Hill on a website about ghost towns to discover that it's been uninhabited since a deadly coal fire that's still burning to this day, almost entirely unnecessary. Which is probably good, because, look, I love Sean Bean. We all love Sean Bean. Sean Bean is a joy to watch in just about everything he's in, capturing pensive concern on his face so believably that his "one does not simply walk into Mordor" expression is now universally recognized as the international symbol of "this is a bad idea, guys." But in 2006 at least, the one weakness in his arsenal of talent was accents, specifically American accents. And this is a movie that decided that what it needed from Sean Bean was an American accent. I cannot do it justice. Literally every time he talks, you're going to go, "What, seriously?" So get ready for that if you watch this movie. As night falls and they approach Silent Hill, Rose stops for gas at a truck stop slash diner slash gas station slash body piercing studio slash tattoo parlor in West Virginia, and maybe I'm being unfair, but I have a hard time believing this could ever possibly be a real business. We see later that it's also an auto shop. Rose makes a number of ominous discoveries over the course of the stop. First, that her daughter has redrawn all her happy, playful pictures of cheerful animals with dark, sinister drawings of some kind of benighted hellscape. Second, that she doesn't remember doing it. Third, that her husband has cut off all her credit cards, forcing her to pay with cash. This is why you should always have at least one credit card and at least one bank account in your own name, just in case something happens in the relationship and you need to be financially independent on very short notice. And fourth, that a motorcycle cop is pulled up and is sniffing around on her quote-unquote gut instinct that something's up with Rose, which is really just unexamined PTSD from a previous incident involving the attempted murder of a child. And let's get into this just a little, because while I think you could plausibly argue that everything and everyone here are simply instruments of fate and we were destined to arrive at this sequence of events no matter what, it's very clear that Sybil is acting illegally and letting her trauma drive her to harass an innocent woman instead of getting some goddamn therapy. When I watched this the first time, I thought that maybe Christopher had reported Rose to the cops simply to stop her from doing something he thought was foolish or dangerous, but nope. He has no idea the cops are even involved until he gets to Brahms, the next town over, himself. We find out later on in the movie that Sybil was involved in a case where a man kidnapped a kid, brought him to Silent Hill, and then threw him down a mineshaft, and it's clear that she was left jumpy and suspicious as a result. And make no mistake, she literally sees a mom with a kid, asks where they were going, and immediately decides that this is another kidnapping and she needs to pull Rose over without any justification. This is the kind of abuse of authority they talk about when they say all cops are bastards. It's not that Sybil is a bad person, it's just that when you give her power over other people's lives, she's going to use it, and not necessarily in a way that she's allowed to. I kind of love that the whole inciting incident of this movie is a cop being an asshole for no reason, because way too often cops in media are allowed the get-out-of-jail-free card of, oh, but their instincts were right all along, and it's really the law's fault for not allowing them free rein to do whatever they feel like. Incidentally, for those of you who might be familiar with Avery's troubled personal history and might be wondering if this was related to his conviction for vehicular manslaughter, no. The accident he caused while intoxicated happened in 2008, and he was convicted and sentenced in 2009. But it is a perfect example of the kind of abuse of authority I'm talking about in some ways. After being sentenced to a work release program on September 29th, 2009, his sentence was changed to a prison term that November because he tweeted out complaints about the conditions in the furlough facility and officials decided to, quote, teach him a lesson, unquote, by simply remanding him to full-time custody. They were angry that he wasn't sufficiently grateful for his leniency, so they took it away simply because they could. In a situation like this, where incarceration really does nothing to get at the root causes of the substance abuse issues that led to the accident, that's plain old ugly cruelty, and it's endemic to the criminal justice system. Christopher calls again, and this time they have a slightly more detailed argument. Christopher wants to put Sharon into a hospital and get her on psychiatric medication for her sleepwalking and nightmares, while Rose feels like the medication she's been on isn't doing anything, and it's clear they need to get at the root cause of the trauma, which can only be done by returning to the place it came from. She hangs up and drives off, after a chilly exchange with Sybil that somehow convinces the officer she's doing the right thing by chasing her down and pulling her over, even though high-speed chases are infamous for causing vehicular fatalities, and there are some lovely overhead shots of both car and motorcycle racing along the winding mountain roads as Rose decides she's too close to Silent Hill to be stopped now. Overhead shots, by the way, are usually used to create a sense of isolation and powerlessness, and it's interesting that Gans uses so many of them for Rose in this film. She's an ordinary person caught up in the machinations of fate, and it's arguable whether she has any agency in the story, even though it's ultimately driven by her choices. The high angles in this work perfectly for that. Rose crashes through the barrier sealing off Silent Hill, then over the bridge into town. But a little girl walks across the road in front of them, and when Rose swerves to avoid her, the car spins out of control on the wet road and crashes. Rose goes face first into the steering wheel, and when she wakes up, she's on the outskirts of a mist-enshrouded town, with ash falling from the sky like snow, and Sharon has disappeared. We haven't been officially provided with the proof yet, but it's immediately obvious that she's not in the real world anymore. She wanders the empty streets looking for her daughter. Rhoda Mitchell joked at one point that the biggest acting challenge in this movie was trying to find 23 different ways of calling out, Sharon! And finally spots her in the distance, racing into an alleyway. Incidentally, before we leave Silent Hill's main street, I want to point out first that the movie theater is playing a double bill of The Last Man on Earth and The Omega Man, both adaptations of the Richard Matheson novel I Am Legend that spend long stretches of time depicting abandoned cityscapes and urban isolation, and second that one of the storefronts is MT Rooms Used Furniture, an inside joke among the crew about how none of the buildings actually have anything behind the facades in either the film or the video game it's based on. Rose gives chase to her daughter, passing first through some residential areas and then following her down a narrow stairway into some kind of underground storage facility. A series of air raid sirens begin to sound as she descends, plunging the whole area into pitch darkness, but Rose is able to pull out her cigarette lighter to give herself a tiny amount of light. This is the film's first transition to the other world, sometimes called the nightmare world in the video games, and we'll get to why that's such a good term for it, but for now you can just assume it's not called the nightmare world because it's a fun place for a beach vacation. This is all a slight change from the original game version of Silent Hill, where protagonist Harry Mason is actually in the real town, and it actually is foggy and snowy, with the nightmare world occasionally overlaying itself onto reality as the game progresses. Then again, there's at least one ending to the game where Harry is revealed to be dead from the car crash, and everything he experienced was a dying hallucination, so you can see how there are some overlapping ideas floating around in here. In the light of the flickering flame, the walls now appear rusted and decrepit, with peeling paint on every surface and crumbling stone. I mentioned earlier that I thought this was a gothic story, and I think it's worth digging into exactly what that means, because I do think a lot of this film's rough critical reception came from people who didn't expect a work of gothic fiction, and wound up greatly disappointed when their expectations weren't properly managed. So what is a gothic? Well, like any definition of a genre, it's a little loose, but it's usually characterized by an environment of dread, the threat of the supernatural, and either the intrusion of the past upon the present, or the haunting of the present by the past. Ruined claustrophobic buildings are common as a symbol of that intrusion of the past upon the present, that which was once thriving is now rotten and decayed, and common plot elements include vengeful persecution, imprisonment, and murder. The story can be discontinuous, convoluted, and occasionally inconsistent, and often involves framing devices and tales within tales. And as Wikipedia so wonderfully puts it, other characteristics, regardless of relevance to the main plot, can include sleep-like and death-like states, live burials, doubles, unnatural echoes or silences, the discovery of obscured family ties, unintelligible writings, nocturnal landscapes, remote locations, and dreams. Basically, any time you have a big, overstuffed couch of a story with tons of bizarre supernatural shit and a protagonist who's dwarfed by a strange and horrible world full of dark family secrets come back to haunt them, you're in a gothic. It was called gothic, by the way, because the author of what's commonly considered the first gothic novel, Horace Walpole's The Castle of Otranto, was a fan of both gothic architecture and the style of baroque, over-the-top supernatural literature of that period. So he published a novel he claimed was a found manuscript from the Gothic era, and when it became a huge and widely imitated success, that became the name for the genre. There are many variants, including American Gothic, Post-Industrial Gothic, and Southern Gothic, that transplant the core concept into different eras and settings, and arguably Silent Hill is many of these things. Rose thinks she sees Sharon in the underground labyrinth of chain-link fences, but what she actually finds is a child with carbonized skin and a face ruined and melted by some intense heat until it slid halfway down and around the head, with an inner fire revealed every time the skin cracks and breaks with every movement, as though she's a living symbol of the coal fires underneath the surface of the town. These are known as the Grey Children in the video game, and they are all here played by the same actor, Yvonne Ng. Rose makes the sensible decision to run for it on seeing this, but she soon attracts a mob of these children, and she hits her head hard trying to push open a door as she looks for a safe place. She collapses to the ground, trying to crawl away, but they swarm on top of her and it looks like she's a goner, but the nightmare ends just as swiftly as it begins. And Rose regains consciousness in an abandoned bowling alley, with Johnny Cash's Ring of Fire playing incongruously on the jukebox behind her. This does break immersion a bit, but it's such a wonderfully surreal touch that I genuinely love it. She goes back outside, finding herself once again in the foggy netherworld, and although the place looks abandoned, it's no longer rotted and decayed. She runs down the main street again, looking for some sign of Sharon, only to discover that the town simply ends in a cliff, as though it's been sheared off from the rest of the world. We then meet Dahlia, who looks like she wandered out of a casting call for a live-action version of the Dark Crystal. She's all bulky robes and wild hair that covers her face like a veil and a shuffling gait that makes you kinda suspect she's being puppeteered. And she explains that only the Dark One opens and closes the gate to Silent Hill. Okay, I'm using the word explains pretty loosely here. Dahlia's also lost a child, and when Rose shows her a picture of Sharon she has in a locket around her neck, Dahlia insists that's her child as well. Rose flees, assuming the woman to be simply delusional. Back in the real world, Christopher arrives in Brahms trying to find his wife. After a little freelance bribery, he gets directions to Silent Hill from a local auto mechanic, played by Ron Gabriel, who, amusingly enough, lights up a cigarette while warning that fumes from the coal fire could be lethal, and he goes off looking for Rose and Sharon. Rose arrives back at the car and finds a creepy drawing of the local school. Assuming it can't be a coincidence, she gets in and tries to drive in that direction, but the car won't start. She calls Christopher on the car's cell phone, leaving a voicemail that she's headed for the school to look for Sharon, but her efforts to get the vehicle started are interrupted by Sybil, who similarly crashed her motorcycle and decides to reassert control over the situation by arresting and handcuffing Rose for absolutely nothing and frog-marching her back to Brahms. Because refusing to cooperate with an unlawful search and seizure is considered to be resisting an arrest, an arrestable offense in and of itself. Gotta love the criminal justice system! Christopher arrives on the outskirts of Silent Hill, and it's already clear that he's experiencing a different reality from his wife from the way he walks through a torrential rain shower that she doesn't seem to be feeling. It's really more of a sun shower, honestly. They make kind of a half-hearted attempt to cover it up with some lighting filters, but it's pretty obvious that this is a bright, sunshiny day, and they're all being hosed down from sprinklers mounted just off-camera. There are cops there blockading the path, but when Christopher mentions the car his wife is driving, they bring him to talk to the officer in charge, Thomas Gucci. Gucci, who wears black gloves that have a very giallo aesthetic, says the car is empty, which to my mind confirms the reality of the supernatural influences here because the bodies have definitely vanished. He doesn't seem particularly concerned about finding them, though, saying he's sure his missing deputy is on the case. Gucci is a very weird character who I feel needed more explanation, but we'll get to that later. Back in the Netherworld, Sybil uses her traumatic experience with the kidnapped boy from 2 years ago as an excuse to treat Rose with entirely unjustified hostility and suspicion, walking the opposite direction from the missing and endangered child while insisting that she's doing all this because she cares so much about kids. You may have picked up that I don't like Sybil very much, something that I'm not entirely sure is intentional on the filmmaker's part. Just then, they reach the border and realize the road they came in on is sheared off just like the one leading back out. They're trapped in Silent Hill, and that's far from the worst of it. Because a monster called the Armless Man, the only monster to appear in daylight in the whole movie as far as I can tell, emerges from the mist with an odd wobbling gait and its face protruding from its chest. It spews acidic spittle at Sybil that forces her to remove both her helmet and her motorcycle jacket before the goop can burn itself through onto her skin. I feel like there's something highly symbolic about the way the town literally strips her of the symbols of her authority here. And even though she manages to put it down with a few well-placed bullets, Rose runs away in the confusion with her hands still cuffed behind her back, and it slowly begins to dawn on Sybil that there's a lot more to this than an imagined kidnapping. Apparently, Lori Holden actually cried when she was informed she would need to cut her hair for the part, but she went ahead anyway when Gans explained to her that she needed to look like a warrior. I think the style really works for her, but obviously mine is not the opinion that matters. Rose manages to slip her hands past her feet so the cuffs are now in front of her, and smartly uses the maps at the local bus stations to make her way to the school. The Midwich School, named after the novel The Midwich Cuckoos that formed the basis for the movie Village of the Damned. The door is marked with a symbol that looks like a hexagon, with crosses radiating from the top and bottom side and the left and right corners, and the cross on the bottom extending further to form an arch with 2 feet. This is the symbol of the Brethren, the fanatical sect of Christianity whose evil incited the disaster that came to Silent Hill, and we'll be seeing it quite a bit as the movie progresses. Exploring the abandoned school, Rose finds a working flashlight, This is the part that feels most like a video game, with Rose searching for clues and useful objects in one room after another, and it perfectly illustrates exactly why video games can't directly translate into movies. It's fine for very short stretches, but it would quickly become tedious without more dialogue and more character interaction, neither of which are a strength of the other media. Meanwhile, in the real Silent Hill, which has no fog and no raining ash, Christopher and Officer Gucci drive through town wearing dust masks and calling through a megaphone for Rose and Sharon. Like Sybil, Officer Gucci is unjustifiably suspicious of the strangers in his jurisdiction, but he does open up a little bit about the town history, saying that the fires caught in November of 1974, and that in the chaos of the evacuation, many of the bodies were never found. He says most of the people who died were good folk, but a few of them deserved their fate, which feels like it deserves a little more attention, but that's Officer Gucci's whole arc. The film is over 2 hours long already, it can't devote time to everything it wants to explore. Rose doesn't find Sharon, but she does find a group of individuals in bulky miner suits and gas masks, searching the school while bringing along a canary in a cage. Fleeing them, she finds herself in a classroom where one of the desks has been graffitied with the word witch, and when she opens it, she finds a workbook with the name Alessa Gillespie written in it. This triggers an odd little Super 8 flashback of a group of children teasing and tormenting young Alessa, who's also played by Jodelle Ferland, but before Rose can wonder why she's suddenly hallucinating 70s home movies, she hears a noise and snaps out of it. She runs out of the classroom, catching sight of a little girl, and chases her upstairs into one of the school's restrooms. Searching each of the stalls in turn for what she assumes to be Sharon, Rose instead finds the body of a man who's been grotesquely crucified with planks and barbed wire. His body has been bent backwards almost double, and writing on the wall literally double dares Rose to reach into the corpse's mouth. She does so, pulling out part of a room key to a nearby hotel. Again, this part feels so video gamey that I can't understand why gamers rejected this adaptation. But just then the miners show up, and she barely locks the door in time to keep them out. There's some question of whether the door will hold, but when the canary begins to flutter and squeak, they take it as a sign and run off. A sign of what, you might ask? Well, seconds later, the air raid sirens begin again, and the town plunges into darkness. But this time Rose has the flashlight, and she's able to see the room crumble and decay in real time into the nightmarish version of reality she experienced before. And sure, this uses a lot of 2006-era CGI, and some people might ding it as a little cartoony, but in effect, this comprehensive and all-encompassing couldn't have been done in camera anyway, and I think if you watch it with your imagination engaged, the idea of what's going on is enough to sell you past the slightly dodgy visuals. The bent-backed man emerges from the stall, now restored to some awful and agonized parody of life, and his touch further corrupts the decayed environment around him until the floor wells up with bubbling pits of slime that birth a horde of giant cockroaches. I love both the idea that he continues to live in Alessa's nightmares and that his touch breeds corruption in everything around it, both very potent metaphors for this man's effect on her life, even though I do kind of question the need for this entire story element, but we'll get to that. Rose very understandably makes a break for it, but she stops at the bottom of the stairs when she sees the miners being devoured by a horde of foot-long demonic roaches and decides that maybe she should find another way out. She breaks through, and falls through, a window covered with chain-link fencing, spotting briefly as she does so an ash-streaked version of Alessa drawing creepy pictures just like Sharon did. This was the girl she mistook for Sharon earlier, but we now realize it's actually Dahlia's daughter, and falls out into an open courtyard where she's confronted by a massive 7-foot-tall man wading through a tide of cockroaches, wearing a butcher's smock and heavy steel helmet that looks like a cross between a pyramid and a plague doctor's mask, and wielding a broad, flat sword almost as big as he is. This is the somewhat obviously named Pyramid Head, who serves in Silent Hill 2 as an avatar of the protagonist's repressed guilt and desire for punishment, and later in the series is a somewhat more generalized symbol of vengeance. In this film, he's clearly the latter, stalking Alessa's persecutors and butchering them in horrific ways. In the real Silent Hill, Christopher follows Rose's voicemail to the school, and there are some shots that are both wonderfully tragic and evocative, and just a tiny bit hilarious as the two of them walk through the same rooms without even seeing each other. On the one hand, it's so immensely sad to know that they're so close and yet eternally separated, and Bean does a convincing job with the material as he tries to explain to Gucci that he can smell his wife's perfume, and the officer dismisses it as a carbon monoxide-induced hallucination. On the other hand, knowing that Bean and Coates and this entire subplot were added purely as a studio note, and neither Gans nor Avery wanted them in the movie, it's hard not to feel like this is the actor standing at the edge of the narrative and pleading to be let in, only to be told, no. It's especially funny because the one way he could get into the story would be to die, something Bean is legendarily good at, but the movie won't even let his character do that. Rose instead finds Sybil, who barricades the two of them into the boiler room and unlocks Rose's cuffs, and even though there's a long and tense sequence where the pyramid head monster stabs the massive sword clean through the iron door several times and misses them only by chance, they nonetheless survive to the return of daylight and the resumption of the foggy netherworld. This time we actually see the building repairing itself, returning once again to a dilapidated but not decayed condition, and the two of them achieve a rapprochement as they examine the clue Rose found and make a decision to search for Sharon at the hotel. If I have a tiny nitpick, it's that Rose seems fairly oblivious to the very real and very sinister way she's being fed little breadcrumbs that lead her from one location to another with the constant and tantalizing promise of being reunited with her daughter. She should be a little suspicious of these clues, but she's just perpetually, "No, I'm sure my daughter is here now," with no reluctance at all. In the real world, Gucci kicks Christopher out of Silent Hill with bland platitudes about the ongoing search, and Christopher decides to do a little digging of his own. He calls the public records office, but as soon as he mentions Silent Hill, they clam up, telling him it's all confidential. I do like this part, even though Christopher's arc is mostly unnecessary to events, because I feel like an important element of the Gothic is the gradual uncovering of the mystery through a series of hidden clues leading the hero deeper into danger and emotional isolation from the ignorant outsiders, and it's nice to see that carried out in parallel by both parents, despite the complete and total lack of necessity of that point. And honestly, being overstuffed and convoluted is all part of the Gothic aesthetic anyway. Back in the Netherworld, Rose and Sybil head to the Grand Hotel, where they find Dahlia fighting with a woman named Anna in the lobby. This was originally going to be Anna fighting an armless man, but this was the day when Campanella was absent from the set, and the director's attempts to tell performer Michael Coda how to play the scene looked so bad it was simply scrapped and rewritten instead. The two of them somewhat inexplicably befriend Anna, who explains that she's part of a group of survivors led by a woman named Christabella who take refuge in the church when the darkness comes. She also says that Dahlia is so hated that even the darkness doesn't want her, which isn't true, she's actually so loved that even the darkness won't hurt her, but the Brethren have a lot of problems differentiating love and hate, and that the symbol of the Brethren is on all the buildings built by the Town Fathers. The three of them find another one of Alessa's creepy drawings in the cubbyhole for room 111's mail, and head upstairs looking for it. Christopher, meanwhile, breaks into the archives after hours and finds several boxes of scorched and damaged records from Silent Hill. It's important to note that there's a lot of poetic license going on here. The real Centralia fires didn't and still don't burn anything above ground, and they spread so slowly and gradually that there's some dispute about exactly how and when the whole thing started. There wasn't a big dramatic burning incident like there was in this movie, and in fact it wasn't until the sinkholes began decades later that anyone even realized something was wrong. Christopher finds a record about a child named Alessa who was badly burned the night of the fires, a record filed by Thomas Gucci, and the picture looks exactly like Sharon. Assuming Alessa must have been Sharon's mom, he decides to make his next stop the orphanage to find out exactly how Sharon came into their care. Inside the hotel, the trio finds room 111 hidden behind a painting of a witch being burned, a painting that seems to be drawn heavily from the real-life history of the town. Anna says that witch burnings have always kept the apocalypse at bay and held back the darkness, which isn't, you know, ominous or anything, and the three of them find a hole in the wall of room 111 that leads into another, more industrial building. Alessa's there, and Rose pursues her deeper into the shell of urban decay and over a deep shaft that's crisscrossed by metal walkways that we all recognize. We'll get a little more backstory on this later, some of it confusing, but it seems like this was a collapse created the night Alessa was burned, and it ignited the underground fires that contaminated Silent Hill. Rose finds Alessa, but this is the ash-stained, creepy, smiling version of her that the screenplay calls Dark Alessa. She says, "Look at me. I'm burning." And vanishes in a swirl of flames. Sybil helps Rose get back across the shaft, which is a good thing because the birds roosting in the building begin to flap and flutter ominously, and Anna tells them they need to get back to the church before the darkness comes again. The air raid sirens begin to blare as they approach, but Rose stops dead in shock. She's seen this church before, in Alessa's drawings. Dahlia arrives, warning them they'd be better off taking their chances with the darkness than trusting themselves to Christabella's dubious sanctuary, but Anna pegs her with another rock and she tumbles to the ground. The three of them run up the final stairs to safety, but Anna's just a little too slow, and the pyramid head appears to lift her up into the air, ripping off first her clothes and then her skin with equal ease. Rose and Sybil have barely enough time to get inside before the doors slam shut. You have to assume, given that all of these things are manifestations of Alessa's bottomless rage, that Anna got it a little worse than the others because she was throwing rocks at Alessa's mom. Inside, the congregation predictably calls both women witches and attacks them, grabbing away Rose's locket, but Sybil fires off a warning shot and they back down. Christabella, who has unkempt black hair and eyes that stare just a little too widely and blink just a little too rarely and look in slightly the wrong direction, arrives to calm the group, and although she acts more reasonably, at least on the surface, she tells them that Anna got what she deserved for going out alone before leading them all in a prayer from the Book of Revelation. This is the last remnant of the sect founded by the Brethren, as old as Silent Hill itself. And they fully believe that the only way to prevent the apocalypse is through the regular purification of the sinful by fire. At the orphanage, Christopher tries to get information about his daughter and her abandonment at the orphanage 9 years ago from Sister Margaret, played by Eve Crawford, but she cites privacy concerns and refuses to talk. Christopher gets physical, but Officer Gucci shows up and arrests him for breaking and entering. He then sits Christopher down and explains that Alessa died in 1974 in the same fire that ignited the coal seams in Silent Hill, and he was there. He tells Christopher that the choice is simple, leave town and let the past stay buried, or go to jail. Christopher asks if this is Gucci's idea of justice, and I love his response as he takes off his gloves and shows Christopher his badly burned hands. "Many different forms of justice, Chris. See, you got man's, God's, and even the devil's. Certain forms you just can't control." I love this notion, the idea that sometimes the devil provides justice when God and man cannot, and I love the way Coates delivers the line with such calm, chilling conviction. It really does make you wonder exactly what he knows about what's going on in the other Silent Hill, especially as... but we'll get to that soon enough. Back in the church, Christabella talks with Sybil and Rose and tells them that only the demon at the core of the darkness in Silent Hill knows where Sharon might be. No one has ever gone there and survived, but Christabella knows the way and she's willing to show it to her if she wants to risk the effort. Incidentally, they don't get many lines, but Chris Britton, Stephen R. Hart, Simon Richards, and Ian White lend such wonderful atmosphere as Christabella's coterie of church elders. They look exactly right for this story, desiccated old men who are dead inside and don't even know it, and the way they follow her around gives such a nice thrill of bleak and overbearing authority to every one of Krieg's lines. It's so nice. The group heads out on an expedition to the town hospital, where Rose studies a map on the wall that will supposedly lead her to the ward where the demon is waiting. Christabella frankly advises Rose that she is probably going to die, and Adam, one of the elders, gives her a lamp with the warning that it will attract the monsters in the basement, but she'll need it to see. Rose mutters the directions, and I've heard some people claim that this is a reference to the Konami code, but not only are there no ups and no downs, but she clearly says left, left, right, right, and not left, right, left, right. More's the pity. The basement is accessed by an elevator that has to be pried open to use, and just before Rose steps inside, Christabella returns her locket as a gesture of goodwill. Unfortunately, it falls open, revealing the picture of Sharon, and as soon as Christabella sees it, she immediately recognizes the visage of Alessa and freaks right the fuck out. She tells the other elders to seize them, but Sybil finally gets her hero moment as she holds them off long enough for Rose to get into the elevator and go down. She very dramatically doesn't go along with her, though, and drops her guard, allowing herself to be captured and beaten into unconsciousness with heavy iron pipes. I thought it was to death the first time I saw this movie, that's how rough this scene is, but no, the congregation has a worse fate planned for her. Down in the basement, Rose has one final maze and one final gauntlet to run through before she gets to the very heart of the darkness, this one populated by what's known in the video game as puppet nurses. They're women dressed in what I can only describe as stereotypical sexy nurse costumes, but their faces are almost utterly obliterated by a ruin of scars, and they're wielding scalpels. They come to life as Rose approaches, drawn by the light of the lamp. These were all professional dancers, some of the same people who performed in Jessica Alba's film Honey, and they do an extremely cool thing that unfortunately became super cliched, where they were choreographed backwards and the footage was reversed and undercranked to give them a twitchy, jerky motion. But Rose wisely turns off the light and crawls between them, and the nurses are so closely spaced that they wind up turning on each other in the confusion. She leaves the light behind her, turned on to keep the monsters focused on it, and enters the final hallway into a revelation that will be truly apocalyptic for the congregation of Silent Hill. Dark Alessa is there to greet her, filling in all the exposition this movie has been hinting at the entire time. And before we get into it, a trigger warning for sexual abuse of a child, which will be discussed briefly within the context of the film over the next few minutes. You may need to skip ahead a little. Alessa was Dahlia's child, born out of wedlock with no known father, and in her attempts to escape the bullying of her classmates, she was sexually assaulted by the janitor in a scene that's thankfully only hinted at. Christabella and the town elders blamed Alessa for the assault, claiming that she was a demon child. There was originally more footage to this flashback, showing that Alessa had miraculous powers that the paranoid sect attributed to satanic influences, but again, this movie is already over 2 hours long, and they sentence her to purification by fire. I'll be honest, I do wish they'd excised the hints of child molestation from this movie. I don't think you really need them to explain why Christabella and her coterie wanted Alessa burned at the stake, and it's such a sensitive subject that I feel like just dropping it in as background material doesn't do it justice. And that's not the kind of thing you want to have in your movie and not do justice to. That said, again, this is all an American Gothic story, and the Gothic always has a lot of hints about unhealthy and toxic sexual dynamics, many of which do involve rape and sexual assault, so it's at least not a jarring intrusion on the story. The town elders took Alessa to the hotel, with Dahlia surrendering her daughter without a fight, and went to the hidden space behind room 111 to burn Alessa and once again avert the apocalypse. But the chain suspending the metal frame she hung over the hot coals from snapped, sending her swinging wildly and knocking the brazier over to ignite the fires that destroyed the town. Alessa survived, badly burned, and Officer Gucci burned his hands trying to free her, which is great and all, but either he was already on the force at 14 and just looked incredibly old for his age, or he is the most well-preserved physical specimen ever because they didn't even try to make him look any different in the flashbacks to 1974. This is one of those slightly implausible and confusing elements I was talking about earlier. Alessa was brought to the hospital, and against all odds, she survived. But her hate and anger against the people who hurt her led her to use her powers to lash out at folks, including the nurse who attended her. That's when Dark Alessa showed up, strongly implied to be the devil using Alessa's appearance, and dragged the whole town into a nightmare world based on Alessa's confused and tangled memories of her trauma. That's why the darkness arrives randomly, it's based on Alessa's unpredictable dreams. And that's why the monsters are burned children, monstrous janitors, and demonic nurses. They represent Alessa's worst fears from her own childhood. No, that doesn't explain Pyramid Head or the Armless Man. Look, sometimes kids just have weird random phobias, okay? Rose emerges from the vision to see the nurse Alessa attacked. This is Lisa Garland, although she's never named on screen, and she's much less significant in the movie than in the game, but she does bleed from the eyes like Lisa. And Dark Alessa delivers the final bit of exposition in person. She herself has, quote, many names, unquote, which feels like a very clear implication that she's the devil, and she's taken on the persona of the darkness and vengeful hatred in the real Alessa's soul. Alessa has been down in the basement for over 30 years, her powers sustaining the netherworld, and about 9 years ago she formed the remaining goodness and light inside herself into a baby and sent it out of Silent Hill to be raised. She did this to attract a good person like Rose, who would be able to enter the church that Dark Alessa is barred from due to the congregation's blind, benighted faith, and put an end to the perpetual torment of the town once and for all. She knows Rose will help because Christabella has found Sharon and plans to burn her the same way she burned Alessa, and she knows Rose wants to stop that. Dark Alessa concludes her monologue by hugging Rose, vanishing into her body in a brief instant of pain and leaving her all alone with the tortured Alessa. This is, it must be said, a pretty significant diversion from the original game. In that version, it was Dahlia who wanted to sacrifice her own daughter, named Cheryl and not Sharon, and she was doing it to resurrect an evil god that she worshipped as part of a cult. Alessa bisected her own soul to prevent the ritual from working, and when reunited, the kid became an end boss that you have to fight to save the world. I can understand completely why they changed things, though. This movie is about the saving power of a mother for her child and the true evil of sacrificing innocence to preserve an authoritarian status quo, and that story doesn't quite map if Alessa becomes a monster at the end. So yeah, I'm good with this. Sharon is found and captured, as Dark Alessa warned, and we have to give some massive props to the chilling, calm intensity Ferland gives to her evil avatar. She's giving a very mature, sinister performance, and it contrasts very impressively with the sweet and innocent Sharon. Gans actually thought he'd have to use different actors, but she stepped up and delivered. Christopher, meanwhile, is escorted out of town and out of the movie, and despite his threats to return with lawyers, we really won't see him again until the very end. Oh, and we get a little coda here to Sybil's story. She didn't find a dead kid in a mineshaft. She found him still alive and kept him alive for 3 days until they could both be rescued. She's someone willing to risk her life to save a child, and gee, how could that factor into the plot? We'll see soon. Because it's the climax now, and Christabella's once again planning to burn a child to banish the darkness and prevent the apocalypse. She decides the fire needs a little appetizer, though, and the badly beaten Sybil is lowered over the fire and roasted slowly to death in front of the cheering congregation. It's a horrible way to die, but it does keep the group occupied just long enough for Rose to arrive. Interestingly, Sybil's last act is to call to her own mother, which is a nice full-circle moment of thematic unity. Rose confronts Christabella, telling her that there was never any apocalypse and the world outside continues the same way it always has. They're trapped here because they're already dead and already damned and they're just too afraid to realize the truth. Rose warns them that there is no escape anymore from Alessa's revenge, telling Christabella, "You are alone in this limbo, and God is not here." Christabella responds by stabbing her straight through the chest with a lovely little sacrificial dagger that doesn't make a whole lot of sense for her to have, but it fits the aesthetic so well that I don't mind. And even though Rose collapses to the floor bleeding out, the blood that falls instead seeps into the boards, bringing the darkness inside the church and ending its sanctuary. It turns the pyre intended for Sharon into a bottomless pit, and from it, Alessa rises on her hospital bed with barbed wire fibrillating all around her like Dr. Octopus's tentacles. Rose's wound miraculously heals, and she goes to rescue her daughter as the whipping tendrils lift Christabella into the air and go straight up her skirt before gruesomely sawing her in half. I'm also not really okay with this implication. Not only does it veer perilously close to the same kind of sexual assault that was so problematic in the original Evil Dead, it also hints at the notion that Christabella is evil because she has no biological children, making her less of a mother than the others and thus needing unique punishment that takes a specifically penetrative and by implication impregnative tack. That's a huge bit of gender essentialism in a film that's otherwise been supportive of many different forms of femininity and motherhood, and I wish they'd chosen something else because this is really not okay. Now, some of the problematic aspects of this might have occurred because apparently it was a last-minute change that possibly wasn't very well thought out. As scripted, several pyramid heads were going to emerge from the pit and slaughter the congregation with a variety of lethal weapons. This wasn't shot due to budgetary issues, and I do feel like it means Pyramid Head simply disappears from the third act to an unfortunate degree, but I think the ending as it is properly centers Alessa's anger and Alessa's revenge, and that part makes perfect sense to me. I just don't like the way they sexualized it. With Christabella dead and Dark Alessa literally dancing in the rain of blood caused by her murder, Alessa proceeds to visit the devil's justice on the entire congregation. Only Rose, Sharon, and Dahlia are spared. Rose and Sharon because they're innocents, and Dahlia because, despite everything, Alessa still loves her mother. Rose and Sharon walk back to the car, which starts up just fine for them now, and drive back over the reappeared bridge into the early morning fog as they head back home. But when we see Christopher waking up to a phone call that comes out as nothing but static, we realize that maybe we're not headed for a happy ending after all. And indeed, there's something so gorgeously bittersweet about the way Rose and Sharon walk into the house, still shrouded by that omnipresent mist, and look at an empty couch while Christopher sits on it in a brighter, sunlit world and can't see them even though they're mere inches away. Rose sacrificed everything for her daughter. And now all that she and Sharon have is each other. Forever. But maybe, just maybe that's enough. At least until the sequel, which has not just Sean Bean and Rhoda Mitchell, but also Kit Harington, Carrie Ann Moss, and Malcolm McDowell, and still got panned. I'll have to track it down someday, but for now the question is, will I hang on to this movie? And the answer is yes, with a small asterisk. Because while I really enjoyed the gothic vibe and the creepy atmospheric intensity of the film, this particular DVD is a full-screen edition. Because sadly, there's a whole era of video releases where someone got the bright idea that rather than put little black bars across the top and the bottom of the screen to compensate for the difference between the square television screen and the rectangular movie screen, they should just hack off about a third of the picture and recenter everything to fit. I always prefer widescreen where available, so while I'm going to continue to hold on to this for now, I'll keep an eye out for an edition that isn't pan and scan, because it really does make a difference. And if you want to talk about pan and scan movies, American post-industrial Southern Gothics, or about anything else that came up on this podcast, you can find me on Twitter as @halfhorror, and on Tumblr, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd as @halfpricehorror. My watch list on Letterboxd contains everything I plan to tackle in future episodes. If there's something you'd like to hear about, let me know. You can also support the show at patreon.com/halfpricehorror, and you can rate and review me on Apple Podcasts and anywhere else this podcast is found. And next time on Half Price Horror, look, the rhyme doesn't go, one Freddy's coming, does it? No, it's 1, 2 Freddy's coming for you, and that means we have a sequel to get to. A sequel that's the most infamous and interesting of all the installments of this slasher series, 1985's A Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2, Freddy's Revenge. See you then.